Hello, this is Robert Stark. I'm here with Ray Sawhill. Ray, it's great having you on.
Robert, it's fun to be talking to you again.
So I think a good place to start off with is let's talk about how we met. So we met on this Facebook group. I don't want to reveal the name since it's a private group. But
it's a very private group, I believe.
Yeah, it's a very, very private group, so I won't reveal the name of it. But it's basically a free speech group, and it's a group for talk that people come in and they talk about controversial topics.
And they do so in very controversial ways.
That's all that I'll say about that group. So I guess it turns out, so we're the only two people who live in Santa Barbara out of everyone I've met sort of online.
Is that right? Santa Barbara should be more of a free speech, free thinking kind of place than it is, I guess.
I don't know if I describe it as suppressing free speech, but I think the best way to describe Santa Barbara, in some ways it's it's so perfect that it doesn't inspire any controversy. I think you kind of need some conflict to create stuff of interest. Santa Barbara, in a sense, is too perfect. You were telling me about some writer that really captures the Santa Barbara really well.
Ross McDonald is the great novelist of Santa Barbara. He was a hard-boiled mystery writer who never actually named Santa Barbara Santa Barbara, but set all his mysteries here. And he did a great job. I mean, it's all set back in the 50s and 60s, but he did a great job of evoking that funny character Santa Barbara has of being very idyllic and maybe a little too idyllic.
So you split your time between New York and Santa Barbara. So those two places are kind of like polar opposites
they
of
sure
each
are.
Other. But I guess you kind of need both. You kind of need the balance between the excitement of New York and then come to Santa Barbara and just relax. You wouldn't want it. Would you want to be stuck in one place completely, or you kind of like that balance?
I have liked that balance. I think moving into the future, I'm going to enjoy more and more Santa Barbara. Just kind of easing it. You know, New York is a funny place. It keeps you very, very sharp, keeps you very on the ball. It can also be a little exhausting, and it's too much time there, and all you really find yourself doing is sharpening your blade. It's good, actually, to get away and ingest new things and meet odd people and expose yourself to things that people in New York aren't necessarily noticing or discussing. Short version,
so,
I'm probably going to move out to Santa Barbara in the next year.
So you've lived in New York pretty much most of your life since at least the 70s. How have you seen it change over the years?
Oh, God, it's gone through three or four different phases in the time I was there. I moved to New York after college in the late 70s, pretty much at the peak of the punk era. It was also pretty much at the trough of New York City's physical decline. If you remember the movies Taxi Driver or The Taking of Pelham 123, for instance, they were almost like documentaries about New York in the 70s. It was a very exciting time. It was a very gritty time, but it was also something that probably couldn't have gone on for much longer. Then in the 80s, all of a sudden, people were very concerned with money. People were very concerned with careers. I mean, not that they hadn't been in New York prior to that, but it had been a more low-budget, freewheeling kind of place. And then there was sort of a dip in the 90s. Giuliani got control of crime, which made a huge difference in the character of the city. Times Square was brought back. And then post-2001, of course, because of 9/11, has had its own particular quality. Currently, the real estate boom is completely nutty. And one of the bigger changes is, when I'm in New York City, I live in Greenwich Village. Greenwich Village was always arty kids central in New York City. But in recent decades, it's become a very upscale, prosperous neighborhood. Arty kids, of course, are going to Brooklyn at this point. And they still continue to come to the city, which I think is a wonderful thing. But the character that Greenwich Village had in, say, 1978, you aren't going to find in Manhattan at all anymore unless you go way up to the north into Inwood or something like that. You really have to go out to Brooklyn or Queens. I don't know if I were a kid today whether I'd come to New York City, because I'm not sure I would want to live in Brooklyn or Queens, but hundreds of thousands of kids do, and that's great.
It's kind of to that point of New York back then inspired a lot more culture. If a place becomes, in a sense, too nice, it's not going to inspire. In a sense, it becomes kind of sterile. Would you say that's true?
You know, that could be true. I don't want to be too much of an old fart. There's a lot of talent in New York, and there continues to be a lot of talent, and drive and talent and cultural energy often move from field to field to field as the years go by. At the moment in New York City, the sort of street fashion world and the food world are really fizzy. It's not a great era, as far as I can tell, for, say, low-budget movie making or for painting or something like that. But currently, you know, you've never eaten better in New York City than you can right now. And a lot of talented youngsters who probably in other eras would have gone into painting or would have gone into music or something like that are in food, and they're doing wonderful things. A friend of mine from California came to New York City and wrote it up for our blog, and one of his funny lines was something like, While I was in New York, I went to a dozen annoying hipster restaurants. Each and every one of them was great. And it's true. Fantastic stuff. Fantastic food. If and when my wife and I do move away from New York City, I think the food is going to be one of the things we'll miss most.
You were actually in a film in New York in the early 80s. It was a pretty minor role, but it was starring Natasha Kinski, where she plays a farm girl from the Midwest who comes to New York.
You found me on IMDb. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't even qualify as a minor role. I just had a little walk on. And if I remember right, I think I walked by her and knocked her over a long time ago. But it was fun to spend a day on a movie set. It was a gritty time in New York, and there were a lot of films being made in New York City at that point. So fun to get a glimpse of it.
So that film, I haven't seen it yet, but does it really, how well does it capture that era?
You know, a lot of films from that era, almost because they reflect the mood of the 70s and the early 80s and because they were shot on the streets, they're almost like documentaries about the time. They can be a little exaggerated, they can be a little flat, they can be a little pumped up, but you genuinely get a feeling for what life in New York was like at that point. The movie's name is Exposed. It was made by a guy named James Toback, who's still around, still active, still dynamic. And Toback's a very smart, funny guy and knows New York City like the back of his hand. So it's the movie, whatever its failings, if people think it has failings, the movie certainly gets the feeling of New York City at that time.
You made an interesting comment. Is you said it kind of had like a Blade Runner-like feel to it, because I did a podcast where I talked about that film. What's interesting is that film was created back then, and it was supposed to be set basically in the near future.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. There were a lot of these cyberpunk visions that came along, and there were a combination of kind of nightmares about the future crossed with, golly, it's kind of glamorous. A funny thing is that the city and much of American urbanism has moved in the direction of things like Blade Runner. There are times when I look at new developments, new buildings, and I think, hey guys, you know, you weren't supposed to be imitating Blade Runner. You were supposed to be looking at Blade Runner thinking, let's not go in that direction. That's actually a nightmare. A lot of the new buildings going up around New York City, a lot of people, there are many, many blogs devoted to what's going on in New York at this point. There are a lot of twisty, shiny, torqued, peculiarly shaped buildings in New York now.
A lot of them are like really, really skinny too.
A lot are skinny. A lot are kind of wavy. You know, you have to be zigzaggy or wavy at this point. A lot are a little blobby. A lot use very, very odd materials and relate to the street in very peculiar ways. They're amazing design objects, but they just don't look like New York City. Imagine you see that in L.A. when you go down there as well.
Yeah, downtown L.A. is going through like a building boom right now, but it's nothing compared to New York, but they're just kind of starting. They have a lot of stuff planned.
I saw an article the other day saying that some of the funny global money that made New York City's real estate market boom is now beginning to move to L.A., so brace yourself. I guess you're going to be seeing more of it.
A lot of it is being funded by, like, Chinese investors. And
exactly,
one thing
yeah.
you mentioned going on in New York is you have a lot of wealthy foreigners. They buy up real estate, but they leave it empty, so in a sense, they're not using it. They become, in a sense, like ghost towns.
Exactly, yeah. There's a term for it. They're called see-through buildings, and they're buildings where people, typically foreigners with a lot of cash, they just want to bury their cash somewhere. They want to put it to use somewhere, so they buy up condos or co-ops in these big glassy buildings, never use them. So you can almost see through those buildings. That's why we call them see-through buildings. it's very odd. I mean, it has a strange effect on a neighborhood to have a building that's quite large yet is barely in use.
And those are in skyscrapers. I mean, they're in California, in places like Orange County, in the Bay Area, in the suburbs, that you have a lot of wealthy Chinese. They're buying up single-family homes and doing the same thing. But that
is
has
that right?
a more drastic. Yeah, but that's a more drastic effect, because buying up land, in some ways, is more significant than buying up airspace.
That would have a real effect on a neighborhood, wouldn't it?
What are some of your thoughts on modern architecture? I know in general, like people in the kind of like the alt-right sphere, I talked about this with the guest, they tend to kind of dislike sort of modern art and architecture. But you're not necessarily, you have sort of a background in the arts, so you like a lot of modern art.
I do, yeah. No, I like a lot of radical art. I like a lot of avant-garde art. I'm drawn to architecture just because I like walking around the world and looking at the built environment. When I was in college, I played for 2 minutes with the idea of majoring in architecture. But at the time, architecture was very much in the hands of dogmatic, very, very leftist modernists. I didn't like their work. And to be honest, I couldn't make sense out of what they were saying most of the time. So I opted for something else instead. I discovered, I mean, I was very interested in architecture, but it didn't fall into focus for me until I stumbled into some very, very interesting thinkers and writers. One of them was Christopher Alexander, who's very well known for a book called A Pattern Language. Another is Colin Ward, who's a British anarchist who wrote very beautifully about architecture as well. So there's a whole different way of looking at architecture that many people simply don't know about. Architecture is this funny art form because it's, you know, it's not like poetry or painting. You're a painter. If you make a good painting or a bad painting or a traditional painting or a radical painting, it's on a wall. It's people are going to love it. They're not going to love it. But it's not going to change the world, probably. A building or a development can actually have a huge impact on hundreds, if not thousands, of people. It's more, you know, it's a work of art. At the same time, it's also a work of politics and finance and economics and sociology. So it's a funny test of, and also they're around. You know, you build a building and it's around for 20 years or 100 years. So it's not something you do lightly. It, in my view, it shouldn't be something that's subject to a lot of fashion, that's a question of chic theory or that's motivated by edginess. It should be motivated by a desire to do something that's contributing to the general good, generally speaking, in a modest kind of way that fits in with its surroundings and that respects people and their, you know, their demonstrated needs and preferences. We're all going to have to live with it. If you were to buy an item of clothing and you're going to have to wear it for the rest of your life, that's kind of the main question that comes up in architecture, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm always eager in my writing and in my blogging to call people's attention to this. They're sold. It's of all the arts, architecture is the one where the public discussion simply hasn't opened up. It's still dominated by elite people from foundations and schools and publications. Everyday people simply aren't having much input into it. They don't even know they're entitled to do that. So I have a big background in architecture. I've known architects. I've studied architects. I'm very confident about what I say. So it's nice to remind people that they're allowed to take in their surroundings. They're allowed to have an opinion about it. They're allowed to look at a chic, glossy piece of up-to-date architecture and say, that's awful. You know, I hate what that does to the neighborhood. They're perfectly entitled to do that. Many people just don't even know that. So
it seems like the people who are really interested in architecture, it's a sort of a small niche. It's a shame because like your average person doesn't seem to be that interested in it.
Yeah, it's a puzzle to me psychologically. Why is that? Do you have any hunches about that? I've got one or two, but I'm not sure there's much behind them.
I mean, obviously, if someone has money, they want to live in a nice house, but people are very sort of just practical.
Mm-hmm.
I don't comprehend why. I mean, people will like they'll travel to a city, and they'll comment, "Oh, this city is a nice city," but they don't. But other than that, just acknowledging that, they don't really get that interested in it the way they would like other fields.
I think that's so smart and so true. I find that a lot of people who have very good taste in food or clothes or movies or who are very, very sensible and intelligent about where they want to travel. They want to go to an attractive city, or they want to go to a hill town in Spain, or they want to go to Tuscany for a couple of weeks or a semester or something. They never seem to ask themselves, well, why aren't American towns and cities that beautiful? Why isn't our countryside that respected? It would be nice if they did. I think in a way, one of my hunches is simply that things are so hopeless in America. We're all so used to the depressed cities. We're all so used to the freeways and the suburbs and the cul-de-sacs that people don't realize it could be different. So they just check out.
What do you think about this whole kind of debate in urban planning about whether we should densify or have people live in like single-family homes? What do you see as preferable?
Well, you know, I have a lot of personal preferences. I'm very reluctant to impose them on anybody. I think you're touching on a question that really, really fascinates me, which is, the two of us being here in Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara is a beautiful city. It has an actual downtown. It has an actual cultural life. It has an actual setting and identity. It's got some American suburban qualities as well, but it's certainly a lot nicer than most of what we're used to in the U.S.
It was modeled after like Andalusia in Spain.
And Santa Barbara, of course, has grown the way it has with some of the strictest zoning laws in the country. I'm not a huge fan of zoning laws, and I'd like to think that people left to their own devices tend to come up with fun, entertaining, inventive ways of organizing their lives. And yet here we are in this perfectly lovely place. And in order for it to be lovely and for us to enjoy its loveliness, we're surrounded by zoning laws. We're surrounded by, you know, some of the most extensive and strict zoning laws in the country. I'd like to think that someplace as attractive as Santa Barbara could grow in the U.S. without that number of zoning laws. And yet places that are more open, more libertarian, they just tend to turn into, as far as I can tell, they turn into Houston.
What's interesting to point out is Santa Barbara is, I guess, a more place run by people who might describe themselves as progressive.
Sure.
But a lot of conservative libertarians, their philosophy is they believe in radical property rights.
Mm-hmm.
You get a place like Orange County or Houston, there's no laws about protecting historic preservation or wilderness conservation.
There's little attention to just aesthetic qualities generally. You know, the whole aesthetic dimension, which I think is important to people like you and me, it's just seen as inessential somehow. Or maybe it's just seen as something you do with your own property, but, you know, it doesn't play a role in civic life or something.
Back to the topic of New York. It's interesting, if you were talking about a lot of these new skyscrapers going up that are these really kind of bizarre shapes.
Sure, yeah.
But if you look kind of at the history of New York, like you had the Art Deco era, buildings were very, very complex shapes, like a lot of them were kind of, and they're very intricate, like the
mm-hmm.
Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building.
Sure,
and then from
gorgeous
the 50s
building.
To the 80s, they were more like box-like,
yeah.
And then now they're more like abstract. So it's gone for these different phases.
Sure. Do you have a preference yourself? I think you're a big Deco fan, aren't you?
Yeah.
I think Deco is great. Deco has a kind of dignity to it. Something about it says urban life. It's rather festive. It's a great way of bringing together tradition and modernity in one. To my mind, some of the problem with more recent buildings is that they just wipe out the tradition and they just embrace technology and engineering and chic shapes, and you know they're going to look terrible in 10 years. They're going to look as dorky as 70s fashions in clothes look to us now. But we'll be stuck with them.
I describe it as an attempt to be kind of futuristic for its time and innovative and create something exciting and grandiose. But at the same time, it has a lot of character and charm to it.
Mm-hmm.
When everything is glass, it can get a little too sterile.
Well, for sure, yeah. An awful lot, and sterile is the perfect word for it. An awful lot of the buildings going up now are made of basically glass and metal, and it's just very hard to have a warm human connection to them. Glass and metal are fine, but if there's nothing there but glass and metal, it feels very, very slick and cold. You yourself do, figurative painting, but you do figurative painting of a very modern sort. Is that a conscious choice on your part to bring those two things together?
I haven't really consciously tried to create a style. I think with me it's kind of come natural.
Mm-hmm.
But my work is, I do landscapes and cityscapes, but it's fairly modern.
It is, yeah. But very representational, very easy to understand, very, very accessible at the same time.
And I've noticed in art people have a tendency to either go for the really abstract or the really, like, photorealistic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that many people doing, like, my style of work.
Were you ever tempted to head in a more conceptual direction? I know that schools like to steer kids in that direction.
I tried doing an abstract painting, but it was a total disaster.
Oh, really? How did you know?
I just looked at it. But my stuff, it's sort of like I take a building, but I create sort of a design out of it, so it becomes sort of semi-abstract in a sense.
Oh, it certainly
but
does.
I have to find something to get inspiration from. I can't just creating something out of thin air is really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think if I were I have zero visual talent, but if I did have some visual talent that I wanted to explore, I would think that letting my talent have some sort of relationship with the visual optical world around me would be a lot of fun. Get triggered off by plants and light and buildings and spaces, all those things.
On the thing of the architecture, what do you think about some, I know they've done some newer skyscrapers that are trying to recreate the Art Deco style. Do you think some of them work, or do you think they're kind of tacky?
I do. I'm a big one for not just preservation, but for bringing back previous styles. There's a whole different way of looking at architecture history. The modernists and academics want you to see it as a progress that leads to today's architecture. There's another way of looking at that, which is that the history of architecture is basically a history of revivals. Over and over again, the forms in the West of Western architecture, the classical, the Romanesque, the Gothic, things like that, they get revived, they get altered, they get adapted, and that simply is what the history of architecture is. It's this constant churning over of the basic forms and ratios of Western architecture. And up until 1930, 1940, this was widely accepted. This was simply what architecture was. The modernist view of architecture as a progress towards a kind of, you know, gleaming and abstract present tense is really a very recent vintage. You go to some place, I went to school at Princeton, for instance, there's a chapel there, and it's an absolutely beautiful Gothic chapel, and it was built in 1930. But this was not considered illegitimate. It was considered a very sensible thing to do. The British Houses of Parliament, for instance, they look like they were built in 1560, but in fact, if I remember right, were built in the mid-1800s. This was just what you did as an architect. We must be form builders, we must be coming up with something new and novel, strikes me as completely crazy, but there it is.
I think
so,
it
yeah,
can
I'm all in
done.
Favor of revivals, there. And I'm all in favor of reconnecting with the past in architecture. And there is, in fact, a very lively neoclassical revival scene. There's a big world out there of traditional, you might want to call it neo-traditional design and construction that's going on. It just doesn't get recognized and discussed much. I like doing that, and I think there are some people in the field who are extremely talented and brilliant, who are making wonderful things and writing beautiful things about it. But most people aren't aware of it, which I think is tragic, because I think the work would suit a lot of people a lot better than this torqued, shiny stuff that were being sold today.
I think it can be done if people are motivated and have the will. It's just a lot of people have this attitude, it's going to come out looking kind of like Disneyland, so we might as well not even try.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's I was interested in is in New York, they're planning this new Moynihan Station, and it's kind of, they're trying to kind of pay homage to the original Penn Station, but there's just no comparison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard to do anything as really glamorous and extraordinary as the original Penn Station, God knows. I don't know. I'll be really interested to see how that turns out. The key thing for me is simply playing by, you know, the rules of traditional urbanism. It's less about style to me. I'm fond of various historical styles and architecture, but The main thing is not to disrupt the city or to do anything in a city or a town or a village that somehow drags that city, town, or village down, or that somehow, if the city, town, or village has charm or if it has character, that somehow mars that. People can do whatever they want as far as I'm concerned, but if they do something that's actively destructive to their neighbors and to their environment, then I start feeling not just aesthetically offended, but a little morally offended, and offended on a human level. And that's, to me, is part of what's interesting about architecture. I can feel offended by a photograph, or I can feel offended by a short story or something, but it really finally doesn't matter, and who cares?
Used to work as a journalist for Newsweek, so you covered art and culture. Can you talk about that?
I did, yeah. I was at Newsweek for many, many years, and my longest-lasting job there was as an arts reporter. I mainly covered book publishing, and I pitched in with movies and dance and theater and a little bit with art and design as well. It was a gas. It was a whole lot of fun. I took a buyout from Newsweek in 2008 when Newsweek, as we once knew it, essentially was on the verge of collapsing. So I've been retired now for 7 years. The Newsweek that you see on stands or on the web today has very little to do with the Newsweek that I was employed by back in 1990 or 2005. But yeah, no, I had I think it was a 15 or 17 year run as an arts reporter at Newsweek. So I once totaled it up. I think I did interviews with over 2,000 people during those years. It was great.
Who were some of the most interesting and important people that you interviewed?
Golly, some of the better known names in books. I talked to John Updike. I talked to Philip Roth. In movies, I talked to Francis Coppola, Robert Altman. In architecture, unfortunately, I never got anything in the magazine, but I had the very, very precious opportunity to spend a couple of days with Christopher Alexander when he was up at Berkeley. I think Christopher Alexander is a huge genius, and so it was a real treat to spend a couple of days with him. He was generous with his time. Both of us were very disappointed that the piece, which we'd been looking forward to, never actually made it into the magazine.
Your primary interest is culture, art, architecture, and aesthetics. A lot of
basically, yeah. I mean, I got into the arts. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
A lot of people primarily like to focus on politics, especially people like on the alternative right. And most I've noticed, like I've gone on forums for things like architecture, and most of the people there identify more with the left. But
I think politics
is a product of the culture, and a lot of the reasons why I think conservatives have failed is because they want to talk nothing but politics.
I think you're so right about that. I think it's too bad. I don't really consider myself of the alt-right myself. I consider myself more of an anarchist, but I think at the moment there's an awful lot of brains and ferment and energy happening in alt-right circles. It reminds me a lot of underground writing from the 50s or 60s. I find it quite exciting. And I think they make a lot of really good points. I wouldn't quarrel with a lot of them. But I think it's been a terrible mistake for the right in this country to just give up the world of culture, the world of entertainment and art to the left, and just let the left not just dictate terms, but own that subject. I think that's terrible. I think a lot of people care quite deeply about television or music or fashion or art or architecture, and if it were discussed intelligently by guys and girls on the alt-right, I think they'd probably win over some more people. Have you heard of the British philosopher Roger Scruton?
I know of him, but I haven't read his work extensively.
He's very interesting. He's S-C-R-U-T-O-N, Roger Scruton. I have to admit it, he's extremely stuffy. He's very brilliant, speaks very beautifully. I did a long interview with him for Salon magazine at one point, generated a lot of controversy. It was a lot of fun. Anyway, Scruton is a conservative of a sort we're not used to in the U.S. He's very cultured, very civilized. He's a composer himself. He wrote a brilliant long book about the nature of music. He's written some of the best stuff I've ever read on architecture. And he makes wonderful points, and he moves from there into philosophy, and he moves from there into politics. To me, he's a real model of what somebody on the right in the U.S. could, and in my view, should do. It'd be lovely to see somebody like that come along. Who do you read? Do you read people on the right who write in really interesting ways about the arts?
I'm looking for that, but I read both culture stuff and politics stuff,
mm-hmm.
but I don't read that many people that overlap. I usually read people that fit into one niche or the other.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, my observation about the alternative right, and this applies to myself, but it would probably apply to you as well, is a lot of people associate with the alternative right because they're opposed to all political correctness or mass immigration. But
yeah,
on
that's certainly a huge motivator, isn't it?
Yeah, but on other issues, they have maybe a lot more left-wing views, like they're pro-environment or anti-banker.
Mm-hmm.
Or even some people are more socially liberal. So a lot of people in the alt-right are not necessarily right-wing. And you were even mentioning that you've been involved with anarchism. You've been involved with, like, the environmental movement. You were involved in the punk scene. So that kind
of
definitely applies to you.
Sure. Yeah, there are people out there. There's a guy named Bill Kaufman, for instance, who I'm a huge fan of. Bill writes. I've met him a few times. He's a really nice, super smart guy. He writes mostly about politics, but he's really smart about culture as well. He calls himself a front porch anarchist, and he's written for The Nation. He's also written for The American Conservative. He's really one of a kind. He puts things together in his own way and is very, very much a partisan of small towns, but at the same time is not your typical left greenie. Bill really should be. He writes in the most amazing style. He's almost like a kind of postmodern version of a 19th century newspaper editor or something. I think he's wonderful, and I think a lot of people would resonate to his work if only they heard about him. So there are people out there. There's somebody named Gracie Olmsted at the American Conservative magazine, a wonderful magazine edited by Daniel McCarthy, and Gracie Olmsted has done a lot of coverage of urbanism, new urbanism. I don't know. Do you know the term new urbanism?
Yeah, it's a movement that's trying to kind of recreate sort of walkable communities. Like, there's a famous example of that one in Florida.
Exactly, yes. Celebration in Florida. There's Seaside in Florida. It's become something of a fairly popular thing that's happening. It's an interesting thing to think about and discuss and get in arguments over, because the question, is it left-wing or is it right-wing, keeps coming up. It's neo-traditional, and that would normally be associated with right-wing, but it's also got its PBS, NPR-type fans who want to walk and want to live in nice neighborhoods and want to drive their Volvos around and eat at locavore restaurants in nice neighborhoods. I think that kind of development is really interesting. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You get the Tea Party types who say that all that stuff is part of UN Agenda 21.
That's pretty entertaining, isn't it? How did you get drawn, as an arts guy, how did you get drawn into politics yourself?
I've always been independent-minded my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always been interested in politics and culture and art, so
mm-hmm.
I can't really tell you, like, the whole story, but it's just something that's always interested me.
Mm-hmm. At this point, I wonder how most of the people who have discovered the alt-right, I wonder how they've stumbled into it. These are mostly young people, as far as I can tell, and, you know, they're living very different lives than the one that I lead. I think some of them find their way there, as far as I can tell, through eating. Some of them find their way there just because they hated their politically correct professors. Some of them find their way there through the game world, you know, the pickup world, the men's rights movement. Very interesting to trace
these
things.
Yeah, true. How did you kind of, you talked about your cultural views, how did your sort of political views that overlap with the alternative right, how did you shape those views based on your life experiences?
Forgive me being really, really ancient when I say this. My political views, such as they are, I was never primarily a political person, and a lot of the time I don't even like political people. But I sort of stumbled into my political views back in the 70s, and there was something in the 70s and 80s called bioregional anarchism, which was kind of hardcore extreme green, and smaller is beautiful. It was really part of an outgrowth of the hippie environmental movement. Very concerned with things like population growth and set-asides and smaller towns, break things apart whenever possible. Anyway, temperamentally, it suited me very much, and it led me into some anarchist circles, some Earth First circles, things like that, whenever I would feel moved to explore politics, which wasn't often, I should add. Funnily enough, as time has gone by, a lot of the views, and I've never really deviated from that, a lot of the views that I held in, say, 1975 or 1985, and that were considered quite radical and left-wing at the time, they're now viewed as extremely radical, but right-wing these days. So I haven't changed, but the world's labeling of the sorts of views that I hold has changed. Also, there was a point in my life when I thought, oh, my God, you know, I just haven't made sense out of politics. I better dive into it for a couple of years and explore it. Having been given the education I was given, I really had never explored conservative political philosophy, so I thought, I better face this. I think I'll read this. And to my surprise, I found some smart people who'd have thought it, very articulate, making a lot of points, some of which, to my surprise, I agreed with. And I started introducing myself to some people on that side of things. And to be honest, some of my cultural interests brought me in that direction as well. I was very interested in new urbanism. I was very interested in new traditionalist sorts of movements in the arts generally, almost from a news point of view. You know, I wanted to go to my editors and say, look at this thing that's happening. Isn't this interesting? Because I found it terribly interesting. What does it mean about us? Look at these talented people who are doing these unexpected things. My editors, my bosses, never found it interesting. I sold very few of these pieces. But nonetheless, I met a lot of these people, and I learned a lot about these worlds. So that's the long version of how I kind of stumbled into all this. You know, I mainly see myself as a sort of radar screen. I've always been pretty good at just picking up what's exciting in the culture and where there's energy and ferment and unexpected things happening. And I pick that up, I register it, I call people's attention to it, I wonder about it for a few minutes, and then I move on to the next thing. I'm rather good at that, and I have a very good batting average at it. I encountered a lot of frustration in the journalism world because that wasn't what my bosses were looking for from me. But nonetheless, I just started finding more and more of interest on the right, and a lot of brainy, interesting people.
In a sense, it is becoming like the new counterculture.
Oh, I totally agree with you on that. Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of friends. I mean, most of my friends my own age were 60s, 70s people like I am. And many of them have done a great job of adapting the life as it's changed over the decades. But some of them, they've just been busy with careers and families. And they think the ideas and the attitudes that are out there are the same as they were in 1975. They don't really register that things have changed. Just the basic fact, for instance, that 60% of kids in college these days are female. I mean, that's a huge change. That's a huge sociological change. But many people my age still think of young women as oppressed and as being denied educational opportunities. They just haven't really registered that life has changed much. I'd like to think that I've stayed a little more, you know, fresh and flexible in my reactions to the world than that. I rely on my younger friends, like you as well, to keep me a little fresher.
What are some of the biggest, like, cultural changes that you've seen? Not so much in aesthetics, but just sort of culture in general. A lot of conservatives talk about, like, there's this, like, great, like, moral decline.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting that it's kind of the question of liberalism generally, don't you find? I mean, there's some things about liberal life which are really, really nice. Sophisticated, cosmopolitan, pleasure-oriented, leisure-oriented. I value pleasure and leisure very, very highly. And yet, at the same time, maybe if it's taken a little too seriously, it does lead to cultural decline. So maybe now is a moment when we need some sort of rebirth of the, you know, the Stoic manly virtues. I'm willing to give that a shot, at least where my own thinking goes. Funny things happen. I mean, as the years go by, you sometimes feel, well, I saw that one coming. And then other times things come along and you think to yourself, that just came completely out of the blue for me. I have no idea where that came from or why it's suddenly resonant. I was just talking with my wife this morning, for instance. One of the bigger changes we've noticed, I mean, it's very, very obvious, but there it is. When we were kids, men did not worry about their builds all that much. The guy who pumped iron and worried about his chest and his six packs and his shoulders and who wanted to walk around like a sort of mini Arnold. Yeah, I wanted to walk around like a mini Arnold Schwarzenegger. That was not there. The sexy guys of 1965 or 1975 were generally pretty slim. So that's been a huge change. That was actually brought about by the movie Pumping Iron, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. That really kicked that off.
I noticed with David Bowie and his death, I've seen a lot of people in the comment sections were like saying, oh, he's so skinny.
Right. A lot of guys were skinny back then. You know, a lot of us, you're certainly no Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm certainly no Arnold Schwarzenegger. And probably when both of us were 15 or 20, we were probably pretty scrawny. And that was okay. And you know, you just didn't worry about it too much. One of the consequences is that young men are self-conscious about their bodies in ways these days that they didn't used to be. They're self-conscious about their bodies. They're insecure about themselves, and they fret over themselves in ways that, until fairly recently, only women did. Is this a good thing? Is this fair play? I have no idea, but it's certainly been one of the major changes in my lifetime. One of the other major changes, actually, if we're talking about politics, is attitudes towards population growth. 1971, 1975, if you were a green person, that meant you were on the left. It also meant you were very concerned about population growth. These days, if you mention population growth, people look at you like you're a fascist. So that's a huge turnaround in an issue of some importance, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, part of the reason I think that is that 70s, the environmentalist movement, their reaction to overpopulation was a reaction against the baby boom in the 50s. But now what's happening is, like, the white population is declining, so population is tied entirely to mass immigration, and that's not politically correct to oppose.
I think you've hit it exactly. I think also the softer parts, the harder parts, if you will, of the green movement have always been very smart and very science-oriented. That was the part of the environmental movement I liked a lot. The softer parts, though, the sort of Al Gore parts of the environmental movement have unfortunately disgraced themselves over and over and over again. It got very mealy-mouthed. They made a lot of predictions that didn't really work out very well. And so I think younger people just got very cynical about it. They thought, well, why should we pay attention to these idiots? They're not sexy. They're not rock and roll. They're not fun. And oftentimes they haven't been right. So a lot of people just gave up on that. To my mind, an America that has a population of 150 million or 200 million is much more appealing than an America that has a population of 600 billion. If somebody says, let's let in that number of people, I just go, wow, that sounds like a nightmare to me. So it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's a personal preference, and it's almost an aesthetic preference. But I think you're right. I think a lot of it has to do with immigration, and you don't dare say anything that's anti-immigrant because immigrants are seen as these wonderful, virtuous victims, and also they're not white. You don't dare say anything that might indicate that you have any reservations about the country's demographics changing dramatically. I've got nothing against anybody who's not white, but I think it's politically unwise to monkey around too dramatically with a country's demographics. I mean, why take the chance?
Yeah, I mean, complaining about demographic change is basically seen as the equivalent of just hating people because of their race. There's no distinction made.
Yeah, so you dare not bring the topic up at all. That's been a huge change, though. I mean, really, people were very, very concerned about it, and it was quite an approved thing, quite an accepted thing to worry about back in 1971. And that's, I mean, interestingly enough, 1971 was an era when the country's population was stabilizing. We'd hit a kind of plateau at that point at around 200 million or 210 million, which I take to be an indication that that's what most Americans wanted it to be. If they wanted it to grow, they'd have had more kids. If they'd wanted it to shrink, they'd have had fewer kids. But people seemed quite happy at that point. Unfortunately, changes since then have really blown things out of the water.
Some people on the left who are pro-immigration, they actually say we can accommodate more people if more people live in denser urban environments like New York. My response to that argument is it's fine to have places that are really dense, but it's not a solution. A lot of people are going to want to move to the suburbs. It doesn't justify bringing in millions of new people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think I agree with you. I think that's a good argument.
places like New York and San Francisco were already very exciting, dynamic cities in the 50s and 60s.
Sure, they didn't need to be more exciting or more dynamic, let alone larger.
I guess this kind of ties into cultural decline. You were telling me there's this whole generation of girls moving to New York City just because of the show Sex and the City.
Oh, well, that's another change that I, in my ancient years, I've witnessed over the time. People used to go to New York City to discover themselves or have spectacular careers or become artists or try out their acting chops or something like that. That's what you're used to. Some of them were bankers, but a lot of them were artists, and that was fun. In recent years, though, what with Sex and the City, what's the other show that was the big one? There's some other show that was a big one. Anyway, Paris Hilton being a kind of pop culture icon. These kids show up in the city, particularly young women, and they're just there to live a stylish sitcom sort of life. They go around at the age of 20 or the age of 25, and they're dressed up just like the girls in Sex and the City. And they're flashing daddy's credit card. They're eating expensive food. They're having $15 cocktails. That's what they're there to do, evidently. They have, I guess, jobs in fashion or something, if they have jobs at all. It's a very strange thing to see, and it's something we've really only seen since about the year 2000, as far as I can tell. But Greenwich Village, where I live, it's NYU, which used to be a real hip place, Bob Dylan's neighborhood. It's now very glittery, it's very glossy, and it's full of particularly young women who just want to lead a glamorous TV sitcom sort of life. Very dismaying, if you're an old man.
You've also co-written some novels and plays with your wife. Can you talk about those?
I have, yeah. I'm married to Polly Frost, who's a wonderful writer. In the last 5 years, she's turned into a performance artist as well. She does one-woman shows. Polly has been a journalist. She's written short fiction. She's written long fiction. She's written plays. Polly has a wonderful imagination and a lot of drive. And the two of us get along well, and we ricochet off each other and have a great time doing that. So we've collaborated on some pieces of writing. Both of us really love sort of blockbuster trash fiction, if you will. So we collaborated on two blockbuster-style novels in the popular vein, which we had a great time doing. We also collaborated together on a long-running, hard to describe, almost like a radio play that was initially produced on stage in downtown New York City. It was called Sex Scenes. It was 17 almost one-act plays that were performed by actors sitting on stools into microphones. And it was a satire of the movie business, which both of us knew fairly well at the time. We had a great time with that, and we had a great run at a wonderful downtown New York City venue called the Cornelius Street Cafe, which is where the vagina monologue started. We worked with dozens and dozens of wonderful, really, really uninhibited and talented performers, and we eventually turned that into an audiobook, which can be found at sexscenes.org. It's very funny. It's a satire and quite dirty. It's a lot of fun to collaborate. I have some writing chops, and I've got a good imagination. I have nothing like my wife's drive. I have nothing like my wife's determination or her ability, actually, to put herself in fictional situations. I'm okay with structure and suspense, things like that. So the collaboration was great. She was able to let me take care of certain things. I was able to let her take care of certain things, and we just had a ball.
One thing I know on your blog is your blog post, you post nudes and erotica, but what do you think about the whole debate about what is art and what's pornography? Because the thing is, erotica, you can make a case that it's art because it's pleasing to the eye.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Yeah, no. The debate over art and pornography is one that's been well explored from many different angles for many different decades. I'm not sure I have a whole lot to add to it, but it's a debate that I enjoy attending to, and it's a little niche in the arts world that I get a big kick out of. It's provocative. You know, there's pleasure there. My general attitude is that if the arts weren't sexy, and I don't mean strictly sexy, but sexy as in provocative, arousing, tantalizing, tasty, all those fun things. If they weren't those things, I wouldn't be interested in the arts. Also, I see eroticism, whether it's just going to see a sexy movie or having a nice time at home with your loved one, or going out and going to a club and dancing or watching people dance. I think that's all part of the good life. And to me, the arts themselves are part of the good life. If they aren't part of the good life, once again, I'm just not interested. So it's sort of a fun way. I blog with, 10 other people. And I think one thing we all agree on is that sex is fun. Sex is part of the good life. Also, you know, the culture generally has gotten very, very puritanical in the last 10 or 20 years. So it's also partly us being very cranky and trying to assert the, just the fun of dirty jokes, the fun of pretty people, the fun of naughty scenes and feeling a little tingly, things like that. It's all probably a little unseemly for me since I'm over 60, but I come out of the 60s and 70s when that's a big reason why people got into the arts, foreign films, sexy performers, things like that. So to me, that's natural. I look at what's happening in the arts these days, and you know, I can't believe that people are judging everything by whether it's politically correct or not. Who cares? I think in many ways the arts should not be politically correct. But
one controversy with art and erotica is you have these photographers who they do these art nude photographs. And
sure, yeah.
Some of the girls in their books are, they show like underage teenagers, but the thing is,
sure,
because it's art, it's totally legal. There's nothing illegal about it. Like, you're not going to go to jail. But
sure,
the book, despite that they're totally legal, they're still controversial, and a lot of bookstores like won't sell them.
Sure, that was a story I helped cover when I was in Newsweek. The star of one of those controversies was a wonderful photographer named Jock Sturgis, who made beautiful black and white, very, very subtle pictures of I guess you'd call them hippie types. They weren't scroungy-hitchy types, hippie types. They were very often very beautiful hippie types, often on beaches, often nude or semi-nude, and some of the people in the pictures were quite young. You could take these pictures as sexy or not. It was kind of up to you. And they became quite controversial. If I remember right, I think Jock Sturgis corresponded with the time when the Barnes & Noble chain was expanding into a lot of the country that it hadn't expanded into before. They were selling some of Jock Sturgis's books.
In the South, there was religious hate site.
Exactly.
He was the guy who led this crusade to ban those books in the South.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised, sure. Yeah, the South tends to have trouble with stuff like that. Jock Sturgis, I seem to recall I talked to him, but I haven't caught up with his work in recent years. What's he up to these days?
I don't think he's done anything recently.
Yeah?
What did he have to say when you interviewed him?
Gosh, you know, we're going back 20 or 25 years at this point. I can't really recall too much. It was, back then, a lot of it was freedom of expression. A lot of it was, a lot of people at the time who were doing sexually provocative stuff or stuff that could be interpreted as sexual had no trouble whatsoever with the books being put on, say, a higher shelf so that small children couldn't reach for it, that kind of thing. And I think most people would agree about that. It's like giving ratings to movies or something. Why wouldn't you give ratings to movies?
Of his work he did in, I think, in France and Germany.
There was a lot of stuff on beaches, I remember. Was he also Northern California and Cape Cod or something? I associate some of his pictures with those two places, too.
It kind of shows how society has gotten, because on one hand, in some regards, society has gotten more degenerate, but in some regards, it's gotten more puritanical. So there's these sort of contradictory paths that society is taking.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. No, it really makes your head spin, doesn't it? It's hard to figure out. Pop culture is, I don't expose myself to much in the way of pop culture, pop music, or TV stuff like that. When I do look at it today, it's all these, you know, it's booties being pushed into my face. It's really quite extraordinary. And yet, at the same time, so much of the cultural discussion has devoted itself in recent years to denouncing things for not being politically correct. So there's a prissiness that's happening and a controllingness that's happening, even as pop culture itself gets ever more aggressive and ever more lewd. It's hard to wrap your mind around, but there it is.
The more lewd people, the cis culture is, the more hypervigilant people are in trying to control other people and push for censorship.
I think that may well be the psychological mechanism. If you get rid of all the governors and the restrictions, that's kind of fun initially. It's a great party situation, but over time, nobody can really live like that full time. So what do you replace those previous structures with? I think political correctness is kind of what's replaced Emily Post, or what's replaced the old rules of society. It's very strange.
I read Steve Saylor, and he posted an article that kind of ties into this topic, how when he was growing up, it was common in high school for guys to shower together, but today that's considered a homosexual, so people won't do that.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I've heard that from young friends as well. You'd think at this point, kids are being raised without the kind of body shame that kids back in 1950 or 1960 were raised with. And yet, at the same time, particularly the young guys seem terrified of being nude around each other. It was very, very common in 1960 or 1970. You showered with each other. But part of it seems to be just fear of being labeled gay. It seems almost to be a way of shouting out loud, I'm not gay. Somebody explained to me, somebody who's into fashion, a lot of young men these days have absolutely no sense of fashion. They have a kind of anti-fashion. And I asked about that, and my friend in the fashion business said that as far as she was concerned, they're just saying, I'm not gay. I'm not metrosexual. I'm a guy. I'm a real heterosexual guy. Real heterosexual guys don't give a shit about this.
I see the gay activism on the left and the anti-gay activism as kind of like two heads of the same coin.
Do you really? How do you connect the two?
Because they both create this controversy and then they fuel each other. Like in Japan, they have a healthy attitude about homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's tolerated, but people don't really talk about it a lot. It's just not
mm-hmm.
really seen as a big deal. And I think that's sort of a healthy middle ground.
Mm-hmm.
I think two sides, they fuel each other. And so with more gay acceptance goes around, more men need to go out of their way to prove how heterosexual they are and how not gay they are.
Yeah, I think that's really plausible. I think it's really unfortunate because it means that a lot of straight guys, young straight guys, are reacting against some of what you might call the gay virtues. I mean, just to be stereotypical for a second, gays are known for taste and style. And if what you're determined to do is say, I'm not gay, that might mean that you're just renouncing taste and style. Yet, look at the great icons of heterosexuality in the movies, for instance, Cary Grant or Clark Gable or Sean Connery. These were guys who were very, very stylish. Yet there was nothing remotely, at least on screen, gay-seeming about them. So it's obviously possible to be straight and stylish and proud and cut a figure, you know, all those things. But at the moment, it doesn't seem to be the case. Young straight guys particularly seem to be in a box where they're either going to be metrosexual, wearing those awful skinny clothes, or they're going to be gay, or they're going to be, you know, slobs with bedhead and pants halfway down their butts.
Yeah, with masculinity, like men, in the past, I think there was this idea where you could be masculine but have class at the same time.
Exactly,
these two
yeah.
extremes, either guys are, you have like the effeminate hipsters, or you have a sort of like vulgar machismo, like the guys who are covered in tattoos and they have like the muscles pumped up in steroids.
It's funny how it's really divided out in that way, isn't it? I mean, it used to be that style, mixing a martini, wearing a tuxedo, knowing your way around a museum, knowing something about foreign movies, none of this was considered gay. None of this was considered effeminate or unmanly. It was all considered, actually, it was considered adult. And it was considered quite sexy, and you felt sort of, you know, roguish and confident if you were some guy who could talk about French movies while drinking a Manhattan. These days, I guess that sort of thing makes you a little suspect.
And the other thing with conservatives is conservatives think that being culturally sophisticated is being a liberal or being like a Frenchman, so they go out of their way
right,
to
yeah.
kind of embrace the worst Hollywood stereotype of a conservative. But
right,
I think
right.
In Europe,
I'm a tasteless jerk, yeah.
Yeah, I think Europe, I've noticed, like, with European, both European conservatives and European nationalists, they're not that way at all.
Well, one of the things that really strikes me, or struck me long ago when people started moving their publications onto the web and we started seeing a lot of conservative blogs, things like that, the conservative blogs and publications were often quite ugly. They were just poorly designed. They hurt your eyes. For the life of me, I would stare at it thinking, why can't they, what do they have against an attractive layout? I mean, it's sad that the left owns chic design, chic web design. It's all considered very progressive. If you go to publications on the left, they tend to look a lot better than publications on the right. It's really too bad. Why let the left have the style?
Do you think we should even use these labels like left versus right? Do you think they're even relevant? Do you think we should just create a vision and just put out that vision and just sort of drop the labels?
Well, I'm flattered that you're asking me the question. I don't feel at all qualified to say anything about it. From a cultural point of view, I'd love to see people just assert their tastes and their preferences. I'd love to see them give things a chance. I'd love to see them embrace class. I have to applaud things like the locavore movement or the retro cocktail movement. These are people who are trying for taste. They're trying for quality of life. I applaud the new urbanist movement because these are people who want to live in classier neighborhoods with perhaps actual downtowns and sidewalks. These strike me as wonderful, significant things. Whether they're left-wing or right-wing, I couldn't care less about. My own little two cents, just to jump into this opportunity you've created for me, is that the much more interesting distinction these days, rather than left-right, is between the globalist neoliberals on the one hand and then the people who are more oriented towards localism or into breaking things up, or to their neighbors, even to their neighbors on the other hand. That strikes me, the globalizers versus the decentralists, that strikes me as the real division in the world right now. But
yeah,
I'm
like you have
really not somebody
someone
to be paid much attention to.
Like you have, what are your thoughts on James Howard Kunstler?
Oh, I love Kunstler. I think he's just great. He's such a vivid writer. He's so smart about it. If I were to, if there's somebody out there who said, what, America's suburbs are ugly? American urbanism is a terrible thing. James Kunstler's books are some of the half a dozen books that I'd steer him to just to open his eyes. He's a wonderful combination of left and right. He's vigorous. He's funny. He's a really, really juicy writer, and he opens your eyes. You read his books, and you look around yourself, and things stand out in a way they never did before. Are you a fan yourself?
Yes.
He's great, isn't he?
We're out of time, so it's been a great show. Ray Sawhill, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you, Robert. This was a lot of fun talking like this. I look forward to seeing you again soon.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.